You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century.
Research and teachers' assistants at Concordia University say that they're ready to walk off the job. 95% of more than 2,000 research and teachers' assistants voted in favor of a strike mandate Sunday. Their union says job security and pay are at issue. It adds that a work stoppage could jeopardize school activities at the end of the semester.
With crew union at Concordia University voting in a strike mandate a few weeks ago, this seventh episode of Discordia explores the history of the union and how their parent affiliation change in 2023 set the groundwork for current bargaining demands.
On March 13th, 2023, all six executives of the Teaching and Research Assistants at Concordia Union, or TRAC, resigned from their roles, creating their own independent union under the name Crew. According to former members of TRAC, their parent union, PSAC, or Public Service Alliance of Canada, failed to support its members in meeting their demands for a collective agreement with Concordia University that included a pay raise above inflation, better benefits for international students, addressing mishandling of sexual violence cases, and the lack of financial transparency around the use of member dues.
After months of incognito planning, the former members of TRAC announced that they had reorganized under the Concordia Research and Education Workers Union, or CREW, which will be housed under the Confédération des Syndicats Nationaux, or CSN. According to CREW members, CSN allows their unions to be autonomous and emphasizes TAs and RAs as employees, whereas Concordia sees them as students first. CSN already represented McGill's AGSEM, or Association of Graduate Students Employed at McGill, which helped them to campaign.
The letter links to a website that was set up outlining their three pillars, as well as FAQs such as, will this campaign threaten my status as a unionized worker? Why CSN? And why do I have to pay $2? The Quebec Labor Code stipulates that $2 is the minimum amount that must be paid in order for a member card to be recognized by the board.
On April 3rd of 2023, 1,700 union cards signed by TRAC members were submitted to the Tribunal Administratif du Travail to recognize CREW as a union which represents Concordia's TAs and RAs. For the switch to officially comply with Quebec's labor union laws, CREW needed to have 50% plus 1% of TRAC members sign a petition stating that they want to resign from TRAC to join CREW.
As we'll hear in the interviews, what should have been a fairly straightforward formal recognition in court was kiboshed because it came to light that PSAC had never filed TRAC's collective agreement. Rather than wait years to refile and continue paying dues to their negligent parent union, CREW organizers decided to campaign for a court-administered vote. They continued building on their momentum in order to get members to join CREW and then held a secret ballot.
Between October 23rd and November 13th, 81% of eligible voters turned out, with 71.7% of them, or 1,044 out of 1,466, voted in favor of CREW CSN. CREW was officially certified as a CSN union representing TAs and RAs of Concordia on November 14th, 2023. At the time of airing, CREW is currently in the midst of a strike mandate, meaning members have authorized a strike to be called at any time.
3 General Assembly sessions were held in February 2025 following unsatisfactory bargaining with the university, where they've been asking for increased pay rate to $45 an hour as of June, protection from reduction of contract hours, and a guarantee of basic job security.
Current rates for TAs at Concordia are $29 an hour, and there's a tiered system for research assistants that assigns doctoral students $29.81 per hour, master's students $22.14, and undergraduates $17.26.
For comparison, TAs at McGill make over $36 an hour, and at UBC, they're making nearly $43. The largest wage gap is with the University of Toronto's rate of nearly $52 an hour.
On February 23rd of this year, a strike mandate was voted with 95% voting in favor. Under the slogan, Concordia works because we do, Crew's mandate could go as far as an unlimited general strike as final season approaches, putting the pressure on the university.
And this has led Crew to switch up that slogan to Concordia only works if we do. According to a member of the bargaining committee, Justin Langford, the common complaint from the majority of Crew members is the increased workload for TAs with no pay increases.
According to Langford, the wages trailing behind inflation rates creates a situation where people feel stressed, burnt out, and ultimately need to extend the amount of time that it takes them to finish their degrees. The situation with our pay and our working conditions keeps us stuck in a cycle of limbo.
As we discussed more in detail in our previous episode, Crew has continued the ongoing boycott of the SMSV, or the Sexual Misconduct and Sexual Violence Standing Committee, initiated by predecessors TRAC, as well as the CSU and GSA, and continues to advocate for changes to Concordia's sexual violence policies, in addition to better working conditions and pay.
Rhea Meyer, a member of the bargaining committee and a graduate student in philosophy, told CTV News that the union made advances in negotiations with the university on issues like health and safety and defining harassment and discrimination.
But, she said, negotiations came to a halt when the university would not provide a satisfactory counteroffer on wages and job security, prompting the vote for a strike mandate. As of Monday, March 3rd, the Crew Bargaining Committee has reached a tentative agreement from the employer to be discussed along with the strike mandate at a special meeting held on March 5th.
My name is Saskia Kowalczyk. I am a former Concordia student as well as a former executive at TRAC Union and Crew Union and a campaign militant during the 2023 union raid that was conducted. I became involved, I think, in TRAC Union in 2021, and through sort of the year and a half leading up to the raid, it became increasingly clear that the structure that PSAC sort of enforced on TRAC, the union local, created a lot of restraints around how student workers could negotiate with the university. The representatives from PSAC head office who weren't involved in the day-to-day operations of the union would take backroom deals with university management and sort of go over the heads of the negotiators who were elected by the student workers. And we had a collective agreement renegotiation coming up in May 2023 when our collective agreement ended. And basically, it's the only time that a union has the ability to change its affiliation. So it was decided in fall 2022 that we would make an attempt to reaffiliate from PSAC to CSN, which is a Quebec-based union that represents thousands of workers in Quebec across many sectors, including education, and in fact represented many unions already at Concordia. And their structure would allow us to have a lot more say, a lot more autonomy in how we ran our union, how we negotiated at the bargaining table with the university, and as well, day-to-day operations of the union to do with finances and other sort of governing decisions.
We spoke with the former vice president, former secretary treasurer, and former bargaining officers of TRAC who were key in the reaffiliation from TRAC to Crew.
Do you want to each start by just introducing yourselves and what roles you play related to Crew?
I'm Maya. I was the bargaining officer for TRAC, so I was responsible for formulating the bargaining demands in 2022 and at the start of 2023. Before that, I was a union delegate in the philosophy department, and then I was one of the co-coordinators, general coordinators of the campaign.
I am Stephanie Eccles. I just finished my PhD on Friday, but I'm still a member of Crew for the semester. I ran with these two on a slate called Transform TRAC, and I was elected into the secretary treasurer position, which was a lot of the administrative work of the union, but also did a lot of organizing. And currently, as I'm still a member, I'm a part of the strike prep committee.
We ran together. I was the vice president, which was sort of undefined as a role. So I got to do whatever I wanted.
This is Becca Wilgosh speaking.
And I was not a co-coordinator. I wanted to be like a regular militant for the crew reaffiliation campaign. And then as time progressed, sort of got pulled into coordinating the engineering department. I was sort of unofficially our like liaison with the other unions and the undergraduate and graduate student associations, mostly because I had participated for a long time in a campaign trying to unite those groups against sexual violence on campus.
Can you describe what the main rallying points behind campaigning for the parent union change were?
Autonomy was the first one, which was basically born out of this idea that the members should have control over our own bargaining demands, and we should be the ones to decide whether or not we go on strike and what we're willing to strike for. The previous union basically told us outright that our wage increase would be determined by some bureaucrat in Ottawa and we wouldn't have much say over it. And they administratively had the power in our union federation to enforce that. They could have denied us access to a strike fund, things like that. But that was pretty relevant for us wanting to improve our conditions so dramatically.
I guess I'll speak to the collective agreement. The collective agreement, which is the document that governs the conditions, the pay in the workplace, was 17 pages long with our previous union. And that's paper thin. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you get past the definitions, you get past the really basic thing. It's essentially what is basically there in the labor law with very few additions, which meant that people had next to no protections against abuses of work. So we campaigned for a stronger collective agreement. Obviously, that ties into what Becca was saying about why it was important that we were autonomous, because with our previous union, we didn't have the autonomy in order to make the demands we needed to make.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess just another point on the transparency is, well, as the secretary-treasurer, one of the issues that we came face-to-face with was that the university would collect our dues and then they would send them to PSAC. And then they would send us this like mysterious file with changing rates of dues each month. And it was always 2 months behind. And so we could never really know what they were sending us. And so there was no accountability in terms of us actually receiving the dues that we were entitled to. And so that was a big issue. And one of the attractive things with CSN was that the way that they're structured is that it would go from the university to the local union, so to crew, and then we would give the federation the portion of their dues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really notable to us that as crew, we control and own our own bank account, and the members' dues come to us first. Those are ours. Mm-hmm. With PSAC, even though they were giving us a portion of dues to go to the local, they still bottom-lined our bank account. And at any moment, if they didn't agree with the executive or if they had some reason to draw suspicion on an executive committee, they could put us into administration and take over our money.
They like absorbed almost $300,000 of our members' money when we switched to CSN.
Can you talk more about what the campaign actually was? The tactics, some of the organization, the strategies, what went well, what didn't go well?
Yeah, we'll start maybe with a bit of a broad history and then that will lead to other questions. So we started months before the campaign went public, obviously, months and months. Well, really, we should start with the fact that we ran on a executive slate called Transform Track, one of the items of which on our platform was to reconsider our relationship with our parent union. And the reason we had that was that, as Becca was saying earlier, we were involved in a bit of a labor dispute, especially in the philosophy department, about essentially refusing work from professors with a long history of sexual harassment and assault. And our parent union didn't support us in that, and they sided with the employer at negotiations at the table with that. And obviously that made us really mad because we were effectively boycotting someone. It was a really effective local action, and we were campaigning for greater protections against sexual harassment and assault. That was a really essential part of the campaign for us. Mm-hmm. PSAC really tried to lock down our campaign. And so a part of our electoral platform was to reconsider our relationship with PSAC. And what that looked like, we weren't sure at the time, but we ran on that platform and we kind of ended up being the executive in this union. We didn't really know where we were going, but we had two options. One was to try to change the relationship we had to make it work better. And the other one was to pursue another union federation to go with.
And there's a legacy with this, right? So it wasn't just like our slate that was reconsidering the relationship to PSAC. It was amongst the members for years and years and years.
I almost want to like fast forward to when we were ready to sort of reaffiliate. Obviously, we weighed our options to see like who could we go to as a federation. And CSN just had the politics that aligned with our base. They have a focus on the second front, which is like outside of the workplace, caring about political issues that affect members in their homes and their communities, which really like aligned with our vision of, you know, not just caring about our workplace as TAs and RAs, but our place of study and our like a place where we spend all of our time as students and just like questions in broader Montreal of what we want the world to look like. And so I think that expansion really like gave us momentum because it was, yes, about all of these details with our like, struggles with our parent union, but it was also very clearly like a political ideal that we were pitching to people and that resonated.
Yeah, we wanted to transition from a service-based union to a social union.
And then the tactics, I guess, it was contentious in the sense that PSAC had kind of created a culture of fear amongst previous executives, people who had been involved in running the track union the previous year especially, but also had just sort of the power of like inertia on their side, and that it's much easier to stay with what is known, and that if you tried to switch affiliations, this would be really disastrous. It would postpone bargaining. It would create issues for student workers that weren't really worth the effort. So we did have to sort of conduct tactically this campaign in phases where basically a team of about 20 to 30 militants were recruited based on their existing involvement with the union and their like trustworthiness, I suppose. And that from there, we sort of expanded outwards in various phases, contacting TAs and RAs specifically that they had relationships with, asking them to sign a union card and to pay an initial dues amount of $2. And then basically we went public at a certain point. The entire executive, of which I was a member, I was the mobilization officer at the time, we all resigned. Collectively, we released a statement on why we were resigning and why we were involved in the raid, and used that momentum to draw attention to this campaign, why we thought it was worth it, and push for those final numbers we needed. So that basically we needed to push to make sure we had enough members agree to reaffiliate with CSN such that we were able to go to the labor tribunal and say, look, we have these numbers and we're going to petition to reaffiliate with CSN.
At a certain point, we were kind of like losing steam, obviously, because we had to tell everyone, hey, by the way, you know, don't tell anyone about this, which is funny, but it's like it was a well-kept secret by hundreds of people. But at a certain point, like we really needed to start breaking into people who had didn't really have a relationship with us before, and to really build up our legitimacy as an entity. And we essentially just rode on the coattails of the previous union track by resigning, and that being really dramatic and exciting. And then using the email list to do it, which was also important to do because we were elected. And so we owe the members an explanation about what we're doing and why we're doing it and why we supported it. So that was important to us as well, just on principle. But yeah, that allowed things to kind of really kick in.
Can you talk more about the on the ground campaigning, like meeting with people, getting them to transfer over? Like what actually had to happen, and how did that happen, like just day to day?
I think the thing that people overlook when they imagine doing something like this is that every single person involved, every person who signs a card, everyone who supports the movement has had a one-on-one conversation with someone else. Like there's no shortcuts. You have to find ways to reach people, and then you have to find ways to convince them to do something. And so we just had a really robust way, structure, strategy to make as many conversations happen as quickly as possible and to be as persuasive as possible. We had the pillars that we told you at the beginning. We obviously had to relate those to people's lives and experiences. A big part of that is listening and going to people and being like, what's your experience like? How does that resonate with what we're doing? And then how, like, why is it in your interest and also our shared interest for you to join us?
Yeah. Perhaps what's different in labor law compared to, like, other things is that we not only needed people to sign the union cards with their details, but we also needed them to pass $2 because a legal union card requires that a member pays union dues, and that's the legal minimum. So you've really got to overcome the idea that this is a scam. So genuine barrier, building up our legitimacy, making ourselves be known and being really persistent. And yeah, talking to people, having real things to share about our own experiences was really important. We had essentially a coordination team who were responsible for different sections of the university. And then under that, we had a group of militants. That's just like that's activists, essentially, but who had committed to essentially do this for the whole semester, working in groups, which met weekly. We had, as an entire team, we met every week.
Every Sunday
to discuss, I guess, like how we went for the week, update on strategy, mm-hmm. when we needed to pivot messaging and stuff. That's when we did the briefings.
We had frequent onboarding sessions three times a week.
Yeah. Yeah, with about 100 people who were involved in the campaign by the end in that capacity. Obviously, as the campaign developed, our strategies had to develop. Mm-hmm. But the way it started, it was a lot more one-on-one conversations mm-hmm. with people in departments where we were strong. And then we just branched out with a lot more mass strategies, a lot of phone calls. Really, as many phone calls as we could muster, just call. It really works. I mean, obviously, things like emails we did, but... Mm-hmm. That's helpful to get the word out, but it doesn't get people to sign.
Yeah.
We did door knocking, you know, we went door to door if we had addresses and we hadn't gotten contact with people at the end. So we just drove around door to door.
The more people we were able to recruit, the more information we had.
Whenever we were able to kind of like persuade someone to support the campaign, we would also then have asks for them where we would give them responsibility. Even if they did not want to become a core organizer, they could still, you know, kind of root for this campaign within their own like circles. And there was a lot of people, like hundreds of people that did that work, which was indispensable to really like succeeding with this, right?
Yeah.
Because it's those interpersonal relationships. And in some departments, you know, it's like we can go there, but really we kind of need someone else to take the lead and to kind of like guide their peers through this process.
I think it makes sense psychologically. Like if you just if you invest, like you have a little buy into something, mm-hmm. then you feel like very...
Then it becomes
like,
your own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right? You feel like you have a kind of implication in it that you want to protect.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
After everybody resigned from Track, it seemed like some other folks kind of stepped into those roles and then launched kind of a counter and quite slanderous campaign against the crew movement. Is that something you can speak to?
Yeah, there were people who were involved in the previous executive who had close working relationships with the representatives at PSAC. That basically PSAC made tens of thousands of dollars off of Track every year, money that we felt was not reinvested into our ability to give members services. And that in fact, we made up something like 4% of their Quebec membership, and they were deeply inattentive to our needs and like what was going on with our membership. And in fact, at the end of the day, there was just it was a huge financial incentive for them, for our members, our 3,000 members, to pay them dues every year. And so they used this existing relationship and like sort of this fear that with being involved with CSN, that we would have a more contentious relationship with the university, various other fear tactics, to use those relationships to run a counter campaign. PSAC, used a lot of really bizarre communications methods. They didn't have like really grassroots connections with a lot of the student body at that point. Like a lot of the people who were involved in the union at that time were then involved in the crew campaign. So that sort of, I think, worked against them. When you talk to somebody who's part of the crew campaign, that's somebody you've been in class with, that's somebody you've possibly had political discussions with related to, you know, the state of being a TA and RA at Concordia, whether that's like led by their involvement in the union or just their genuine views on that topic. And that when you get like these mysterious and kind of weirdly aggressive emails from a stranger you've never met, you're going to be like a little bit put off. And I think we really tried to take that in stride. In fact, I was really involved with the communications, and we'd utilize the memes that like we had been sending each other in the group chat amongst the militants. That was really sort of like keeping people in high spirits. And then we like used those on Instagram. A lot of them like were like memeing those weird emails that they They sent us, like, famously, they sent us one trying to explain why the campaign, the raid was occurring. And in it, they said, why are they doing that? And that became kind of like a rallying cry for us. And so that was pretty fun. They were ultimately unsuccessful. And then they exploited sort of a loophole towards the end of the campaign that sort of forced the campaign to continue into the fall of 2023 and go to a vote.
We were overturned in the court, basically, because PSAC had never filed our collective agreement, which meant all of those rules and stipulations that we talked about at the beginning that set the time period for reaffiliation didn't apply. Matter.
And so that's why we had to do the, I guess, third campaign.
Yeah, that's why it went to a vote.
Secret ballot.
We had well over a majority of union cards of people who had resigned from PSAC and signed with us. But essentially, through legal trickery, we ended up with a vote. We had to do a lot of the work again during the second campaign, during a vote, and there's a lot of uncertainty, and it was difficult to keep everybody motivated. But we had a huge turnout for the vote, and 71.9% of the workforce voted in favor of changing affiliation. It's hard to get 71.9% of people to agree on anything.
I don't think it set us up on the wrong foot with the university, though. I actually think it's done the opposite. Like, the momentum that we created in that campaign is now, you know, impacting things like the really high strike mandate vote that we just had.
Yeah.
And absolutely. So, and Concordia is afraid of our ability to mobilize. They've seen those numbers.
Mm-hmm. In terms of your discussions with people, like other students who were part of TRAC or then part of CREW, like, what came up often as, like, the maybe the hesitance for someone to kind of even understand that they were part of a union or that they like had some kind of, you know, because I think there's a lot of people who are just like, I'm here to get my degree.
Yeah.
I have a part-time job. I'm not, like, really identifying with this, like, greater struggle.
Yeah. I should say a lot more people rely on this job for their income than you'd think. For a lot of people, it's not just, like, a throwaway thing. It actually is their primary source of income, especially international students.
Yeah.
Who have restrictions of working off campus, and the university obviously can abuse that because this is one of the few places where you can get work that won't get you thrown off your visa.
With international students, what you have happening is when they come to Canada, when they come to study, they're working for their supervisors, right, as a TA or RA. They also have the supervisor as their guarantor, so on their leases, on, like, other financial related things. And so they're really in this bind where if they were to do something that would, you know, kind of like unsettle the relationship that they have with their supervisor, they do fear that they could be literally deported. And so you have them in these, like, impossible situations where they then don't want to use their, like, legal right to participate in the union or other sorts of, like, political activism on campus.
We did face some of these sentiments, but often it was a question of putting it in a way that was, like, understandable to them based on where they're coming from, right? Like, it often wasn't, like, we need to convince you of the political convictions of our union. It was, we need to convince you that it's safe for you to put your name on this piece of paper and no one's going to come for your family.
I'm curious about what your own kind of personal, like, evolutions have been. Since this has been a few years, I think it's been almost exactly
2 years.
2 years since executives all resigned. How you relate to, like, work, how do you act in solidarity with others in this, like, the limbo of the university?
I think what the campaign did was, like, make me understand how to create change and, like, feel empowered to do that. I think it did that for a lot of people. Like, we saw a lot of people's lives change outside of what they were doing because they felt so empowered by it, which is incredible. I'm included among those people.
Yeah, Becca and I fell in love, so that was a good start, I think. I guess, like, I had some union experience going to this. Like, I kind of knew very broadly what a union campaign is like. Like, I really saw it. I was trying to look through this as much as possible from a labor perspective as well. Like, when we did the, in the philosophy department, when we campaigned against sexual harassment and assault, I really wanted to emphasize that this is a labor question because it had been explored from the perspective of, like, being a student or through student associations. But I think it was important to emphasize that a lot of people, myself included, their studies, graduate studies are funded through being a teaching assistant. And these are like, essentially, it's essentially their job for 2 years or more. And the university requires these roles to function. It's not just like a gift to students, like an extra piece of funding. You know, I think it is funny to think back at it because, I mean, we talked a lot about this at the time. Mm-hmm. We resigned, 2 years ago now? Mm-hmm. I remember, like, sending the email, the final email in our MailChimp in the Hive Cafe at, like, 8 in the morning. And they're just, like, sending an email and being like, well, that's it. Like, awaiting the phone call that would, like, send us into administration. But we had, like, spent so much time building up this union. It was really in a horrible state. And we really poured our hearts into track, which is funny to, like, say now. But, like, we really, really, like, loved it and worked hard on it. And it was a very strange feeling to feel like we have to destroy it to, like, make something new.
Why is it important for education and research workers or TAs and RAs to have a strong labor union that represents and fights for them?
I think the university is a space of, it's a very political space. And I think that the university as a research institution is unable to work unless TAs and RAs work. And so it's so deeply important that people are compensated fairly, are protected in the workplace against unethical practices around issues of like workplace harassment, but also just issues of work insecurity. Many of our members are international students who are PhD students who, until recently, due to legislation from the Canadian government, were unable to work outside the university. And so if you're going to work within the university, you need to be protected. You need to have strong protections to ensure that you are rehired or you have clarity on when you'll be paid. You should be paid on time. You should be paid a living wage. Many of our student workers are living at or below the poverty line in Montreal because of the nature of the work. So basically having student workers make the rules, be involved in their own governance as a union, we viewed as utterly important, and that we were unwilling to allow sort of strangers from Ottawa or from some office in Montreal that no one's ever been to come in, sit down with the university, tell the university we know what's best for these workers when they're never there. And instead, we felt that the people who know the best and can understand the day-to-day issues that student workers at Concordia are facing are those student workers themselves.
I know not all of you are involved in the current organizing around the strike mandate, but can you speak at all to some of the bargaining demands and if they are in line with what you were putting on the table 2 years ago?
I think in a way they align with what we were fighting for in the campaign. Like, wages are a big problem. We were campaigning 2 years ago about not being paid as much as TAs at McGill, who at the time were making $33 an hour, which was 2 years ago. Concordia has offered us $32 an hour
before tax.
And that's for which students? Because it's different
It's all TAs, and the RAs are like still tiered, but we're also fighting to abolish the tiers because we don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. But like that is sort of the top pillar, and then like job security, because they're constantly threatening us with austerity. Mm-hmm. The university budget is brought up over and over and over, despite us having a very small percentage of that budget in total and having no control over how they manage it. And so we want wages, job security, and it keeps coming up over and over, but like protection against harassment and retaliation for reporting it remains one of our key asks, mm-hmm. and that they continue to hold out on, which I would say is always a sign that they know there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so these are the things that are in question and that are being basically stated as non-negotiables at the table that could result in our strike if Concordia can't give us a fair offer on it.
My name is Michael Iantorno, and I'm a PhD candidate here at Concordia University. And I characterize myself as a game history and game labor researcher. And I come from labor at a few different angles. I was an organizer with Crew CSN for a while. I helped work on the campaign where we transitioned union federations. And I've done some labor research as part of a MyTax grant where I studied unions and worker co-ops in the Canadian game industry.
Great. So how would you explain the ways that student unions are particularly situated in the context of labor unions more generally in Quebec?
So I think one of the ways that student unions are kind of unique is that almost every person in a student union has an expiry date. We're all students. We all have to leave after 2, 4, maybe 6 years if you're a late year PhD such as myself. So it's difficult to organize in a lot of ways because you have a very limited amount of time to kind of absorb and mobilize institutional knowledge. And we see that a lot in the sort of churn that happens around the university. I think that people are always looking for other folks to succeed them within the union. And there's a very deliberate tactic on behalf of the university to kind of wait for students to leave. So it creates this kind of very interesting time dynamic that I haven't seen in past unions that I've been a part of.
I think apathy is a major problem or force that people are always like working against, or in particular around like student unionization, where the fact that you're only there for a short time versus, you know, not necessarily being aware of what that grants you, It's kind of hard to make people care about something that they didn't realize that they could have lost at some point, or?
Yeah, and it's also like the work that you do as part of the union is often a very small part of your work as a student too. Because I think one of the sentiments we hear is folks are so buried in their studies, plus they have jobs outside of school, that being part of that union, having that job within the university is maybe like the third or fourth most important thing related to their career or their studies at any given time. So that's really difficult too, especially when you consider that the school is so subdivided into these little departments and faculties and stuff. Like, it's hard for me to have solidarity with like business students because I don't think I've had a conversation with a business student, and I've been at the school for like 6 or 7 years now. Right. So we're all ostensibly part of this union, but we never really get to meet each other unless you're like really active in the union scene. It feels very liminal, your experience in education, a lot of the time, especially like undergrads. I feel they see it as like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to get out of it at some point, so I'm not going to overly invest in it. And any perceived disruption to like that set path through a degree, I've seen people react to it in very hostile terms. So not exactly a labor union, but the student unions voted to strike a few times for very good reasons over the last couple of years. And some of the vitriol I saw towards some of these even soft pickets around campus was just like wild. People were really upset that they were having one class canceled or like they had to move online or something. And maybe it's a neoliberal thing where people are like, oh, I just need to get this degree and get the job, and you're stopping me from doing that. And like a lack of wanting to, quote unquote, like join the struggle in a lot of ways. I think the disconnect I saw is like, you're not, this is like the alleged like framing of it. When you go on strike, you're actually disrupting other students and not the university, which I think is like a fundamental misunderstanding there. I do want to sympathize a little tiny bit because it is a little harder to understand that dynamic. Because when it's labor, it's very straightforward. It's like we're basically shutting down the business and stopping people from profiting from money. But as a student who's like boycotting classes as part of a student union, it is like partially symbolic, but the disruption takes on like a broader meaning and it gets you press attention and it works in so many other ways that help your cause too. So it's harder to kind of like understand that. Honestly, and one of the things we talked about when I was doing labor research is like a lot of folks just don't learn about these sorts of things in school. So when they encounter them for the first time, it's very hard to kind of wrap your head around it. It's not part of like a high school or even an undergraduate education. So like if you have never talked to anybody about unions or labor strikes or anything like that, when you first encounter them, it can be hard to parse through in some ways.
Can you speak to just your engagement or remind me of your role?
I was a member of the union. I'm no longer a member of the union. There's no ill will. I just am no longer a TA or an RA. It kind of happens at the end of the PhD sometimes. I actually first got involved with the union as an agitator against the union because they had canceled the online component of their AGMs. And this was still pretty early on in the pandemic, and I was really upset about it because I know a lot of people who were not comfortable meeting in physical space, and they could no longer basically participate in the union. So I don't want to get into like the tick and tack of that, but eventually we got them with an open letter from some folks and some other mobilization to essentially agree to doing hybrid AGMs, which is lovely. And then I ended up joining the equity committee on the union for a while when it still existed. I think it's defunct now. So I was an equity committee member, and I was a union member, and I helped switch the affiliation of the union with some campaigning. I basically, in regards to that, I attended some events for strategizing. I actually volunteered to reach out to folks in the Humana Indie programs, because at the time the union did not know that they existed, which I actually think is the university's fault for not really giving them a departmental affiliation, but whatever. And then I did some lab-based mobilization. I'm less embedded in a department, but I'm really embedded in this milieu ecosystem, which is a bunch of research labs that are interdisciplinary. So I was kind of reaching out to people who aren't really part of their departments anymore and telling about the affiliation change and what they can do and explaining things to them and getting them to sign union cards when we were doing that. So that was really my involvement with the union.
Can you tell me anything about the Quebec context in terms of student union movements?
A little bit, yeah. So I will say I am from Ontario. I moved here when I was starting the master's about 6 or 7 years ago. And the change in attitude in regard to labor was like very noticed right off the bat. I wasn't here for the student protest that happened, but I have worked with CSN and I've seen that the power that unions have in this province. And it's like a lot more than I saw in Ontario and that I've read about in like other provinces. So there's something unique and maybe powerful about how we do labor organization in Quebec. And I think when I relate it to my research that I do tangentially to my PhD, oftentimes new labor ideas kind of start here. So I really do think like it's easier to gain momentum for that sort of thing. And I do think there's a little bit more sympathy from workers when these initiatives come around. So one of the things I've noticed is that student unions and other groups within the universities here are very sympathetic to labor issues happening across the province and are very eager to kind of find ways to help. It's somewhat surprising in a very good way. It's not like an unusual thing. These labor disruptions, these protests, they should be part of the discussion at all times.
And why did you call yourselves crew?
Oh, that was fun.
We had a long discussion, but it's the Concordia Research and Education Workers Union. We wanted to emphasize that we were workers. So having something to do with labor in there was important.
That we weren't just assistants
because
we end up teaching entire courses.
Yeah. Should we talk about the injunction? This is a big bonding moment for us.
We received
the week that we publicly resigned, the executive team, mostly we received an injunction from PSAC about contacting members about the campaign. And this was like not going to go anywhere. But the idea was to slow us down and maybe to make people afraid.
Yeah.
Because an injunction, like it was like essentially we got it that evening, you have to be in court the next day. It's intimidating because they send a bailiff to your door. They didn't have
expensive.
Yeah,
to
it's
do
an
this.
Expensive exercise. So I don't have a copy, but you know,
neither.
They send this huge document to your door by a court bailiff and be like, be at the Montreal courtroom at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. So we got this like on a Thursday or something.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day,
we
roll up to CSN at 9:30 at night to like essentially swear affidavits, plan this legal thing. But that was a moment where we really just felt really strong and united and really close together.
But
like,
also very impressed with CSN because we were still getting to know each other and they had this incredible lawyer, Emily, who's still with us today, with us that evening, just making sure
just
that
on
we
the
were
fly.
Taken care of.
Yeah, on the fly that evening, making sure everything got sorted and done.
And that's something we never thought or never had with PSAC, right?
Yeah,
totally. So we actually had legal representation.
And our advisors were there, like a whole team of three, and just drinking beers and helping us not freak out about what was happening.
Yeah.
And like that kind of relationship building is like
vital.
That's what all organizing is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like what we continue to
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I guess I'll say like I'm not involved any longer. I graduated last year, but seeing how this culture of organizing has persisted is really encouraging. It's so wonderful to see people who I trained, I got involved, who are now like really either in the central parts of this union, carrying this on, passing on this information, this tradition of organizing that exists within the university and within like even like the Quebec labor movement through CSN is really wonderful to see. And it makes me feel very encouraged for what's to come.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
Moving into our discussion, Piper.
What is your own relationship to track or crew, or have you been a TA or RA at Concordia?
Yeah, so I've been both. I did my undergrad and master's at Concordia, and during my master's, I worked as a teaching assistant. I was a research assistant. Yeah, so at Concordia, I've worked as both a TA and an RA.
describe that experience. Like, did you have positive experiences? Did anyone from crew try to reach out to you to get you to sign a member card?
So I feel lucky in that the professors I worked with were professors I had close relationships with in my department, and I had generally very positive experiences working with them. But yeah, so I remember getting that secret message, very unclear, of somebody not in my cohort, but in my program, sending me a message being like, hey, super top secret, can we meet up and talk? And so we met in a park and went for a walk on a snowy day, I believe. And so she told me about the crew campaign and asked me to sign my union card and pay that initial dues of $2. This was someone I knew. This was someone I definitely considered to be more or less like in my community and in my broader circle of friends. And so it was a kind of a no-brainer. And, you know, being in school and working, I was working a couple of contracts at the same time, TAing and RAing, and I had a job outside of school. So I was really like, okay, I'm going to take your word for this. Sounds good to me. I sign. Show me the dotted line. And then proceeded to receive emails both from crew about the campaign as they went public, and then also from track with the kind of counter campaign, as Saskia and the others mentioned. Some former track executives stepped up to fill the roles that had been vacated and ran this like very slanderous counter campaign. Yeah, how about you? How aware of this campaign were you?
You know, being in the humanities PhD, one of the common, enduring, very strong complaints of that program is such limited access to contracts like TAs and RAs, because there's no undergraduate department that you would have if you were, you know, doing a PhD in English, and there'd be all these classes that would, you know, seemingly be available for you to teach. So I've worked a few contracts as a TA and RA, but I was always like trying to get into it rather than being like, oh, I have these contracts that are failing me in some way, or I'm being mistreated. It was like almost this desirous, I wish I had access to these contracts. But at the time in September 22, I was teaching my own class. And so I think I was fairly removed in a lot of ways from the campaigning. I remember getting emails just because I guess I had been part of track at some point. Like, I'll sign a member card if I get that. But this is just kind of, I'm an alumnus of it. And I think that actually speaks to something, Piper, you and I were talking about before recording, is what prompts the kind of move from you being in a union and that just being, you know, something that is almost like this abstract affiliation you have by signing a contract and, you know, you share with thousands of people, but you might not actually feel any kind of shared struggle with them, versus the kinds of like community building, neighborliness, and like friendship that we've seen so beautifully come up in our interviews, where, you know, it sounds like people are meeting every week, sharing meals, building friendships, building relationships even. And I think that the context of the pandemic really shapes the story here, where there's a lot of people who for several years weren't going to class, or, you know, if they were teaching classes as TAs, were doing that online, weren't necessarily having the same kinds of engagements with like peers as they would have normally. And so that kind of isolation not only sets you up maybe for a greater kind of abuse of power, in that you might not know your rights or might not feel like a common struggle, but it also, I think, maybe is one explanation for why there was such a sweet response for an onboarding of up to, I think I said, like 100 members and crew who were like militants by the end of this campaign, where maybe people were looking for some kind of community that just signing a membership card didn't necessarily grant you access to.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that. Thinking of my own experience, my cohort never had a single class together. And then, you know, you have 1 year of classes and then you go to thesis writing year in a lot of master's programs. So for me and my peers and people in the years around me, we really, I think, were hurting for that sense of community and camaraderie. I can see how that would kind of help sustain itself, in that it's this twofold thing of like, you're working towards something you believe in, but you're also filling this kind of need for community and connection that a lot of people were really hurting for at the time.
One thing I really like coming out in our interviews and in some of the research we did was how prominent the links with sexual assault mishandling by the university, how much of a keystone that was for previous track executives to actually campaign for something else. And it was a big part of their, I guess, grievances, that they felt like they had not been supported by their parent union. And that continues to be something that is part of their bargaining demands. And it makes a lot of sense that that there's a sort of same system at work here, where the same kinds of power dynamics that produce rampant systemic sexual violence and it's being kept behind closed doors are the same things that allow TAs and RAs to be exploited to the extent that they are.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have these kinds of unchecked relationships with serious power imbalances where you're working for professors and it's really easy. I think you said this before, like you work a few extra hours here or there, relationship lines get blurred. Or in our previous episode, we talked a lot about this issue of sexual violence on campus and the mishandling of it by the university administration and how it can affect people's lives as students and their access to education. And something we didn't really get into that has really come up through this episode is how it affects you as a worker as well, right? And how the right to safe working conditions also means being able to refuse work with accused sexual predators.
Not to mention the jobs at universities like Concordia and McGill are really some of the only options for like English speaking students who have, you know, I don't really think there's such a thing as like skilled and not skilled work, but like a specialized, fairly niche disciplinary expertise for you to be able to exercise and train in that in English at the beginning of your career. You need the access to those resources. There's a lot of grad programs that require you to be a TA and teach several classes because they see that as integral to you building a portfolio. And even though I think there's some things that are great about that, that also opens a whole other can of worms as to the abuses of power that are possible when that is obligatory.
Yeah. Getting into the specifics of like what work we do as TAs or teaching assistants and RAs, research assistants, when I TA'd, I was lesson planning. I was writing and conducting original lessons. I've helped with grading and crits. As an RA, I was conducting original research, producing original content from that research for the broader research work of professors I was working under. This is work that is essential to the university as a research institution. And that's one of the points, right, that the crew members have been driving home.
Yeah, and I think there's something that can be easily exploited, even unconsciously, by the fact that professors also suffer under and as a result of the neoliberal university, and often many of them are also kind of dealing with meager resources or like job precarity, or, you know, maybe on a part-time contract, of which there are more and more of, or a limited turn appointment, or just sessional instructors. And if they need a TA, probably are already behind in some ways with what they have to get done. And even if they might support the demands of like, yes, you should be paid well, you should never work hours beyond like what you're paid for, the conditions get set up for TAs to maybe take on more than they should just because the prof themselves is also struggling. And I've had experiences with that where profs are extremely disorganized. And so I'll be waiting for emails and send me along the assignments that I'm going to do my grading part for. And if they don't get it to me by a week before my contract ends or something like that, then it's like, I don't know how to support you in this in a way that feels ethical to me, even though I don't see you yourself as actually being the bully or the man or the money bags here. It's this kind of chain of command that is not really helping most people.
Academia really demands a lot of overworking, and when profs are overworking, even when it's not their intention, it ends up trickling down, right? Their overwork becomes your overwork.
Because it is expected of everyone to kind of reach beyond what they should in order to like have any hope of success, then that is your expectation as well, to sort of play the game. Otherwise, you're being entitled to something that other people were not able to access.
Well, yeah, it's interesting now because the current campaign and the strike mandate, they've just achieved this strike mandate. So this is unfolding. Like, I'm still getting emails from crew keeping me up to date. And I like this quote. So Rhea Meyer, who is a member of the bargaining committee and a grad student in philosophy, says on the crew Instagram that due to the ever-rising tuition costs, general increases to the cost of living, this is the worst time to be a student in Concordia's history, and that improving working conditions for TAs and RAs not only would let us live in dignity, it also makes higher education more accessible. And I think that's a really important point.
Just thinking of, if I could have worked even 10 hours a week at $45 an hour, it would have changed my life. it seriously would have, I mean, my PhD wouldn't have been 6 years, that's for sure. And I consider myself lucky that it was only that long. And I think that it really is like nothing to be sneezed at. Even if you are only working a few hours a week, how much that can like really make the difference between you finishing your degree, having space to not be burnt out, have feeling like you're actually being valued for the incredible amount of not just work you're doing, but what it actually takes to kind of invest in the university and in academia itself is just so unbelievably existentially hard. I think that getting at least well paid for it protects you from burnout.
Students aren't just students. They aren't just workers. They're also people, and they need to have time to relax and socialize and participate in other forms of activism too, if they'd like. And that's all stuff that you need time and energy for. As of Sunday, March 9th, the crew members voted to reject a tentative agreement put forward from the employer. As a result, the bargaining committee has called for a strike of unlimited duration, halting all TA and RA contract work as of March 12th.
Thank you to Saskia Kowalczyk, Becca Wilgosh, Stephanie Eccles, Maya Walmsley, and Michael Iantorno for interviews, our volunteers for their work on this episode, and to the CRFC Radio Meters program for funding Discordia.
Contact us at discordia@cjlo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode in the archives at cjlo.com, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Tune in on Monday, March 24th at 6 p.m. for our next episode on the 2024 Student Solidarity Encampments for Gaza.